A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one, and it's not a hypothetical. Lindsey Graham died today at 71, and Netanyahu's statement called him one of Israel's greatest friends. Daniel's asking us to walk through what that actually meant, structurally. Not the speeches, not the soundbites, but how Graham functioned as the institutional bridge between a Trump-era Republican Party and a maximalist pro-Israel security posture. And honestly, the timing here is brutal, because Iran's nuclear program is reportedly weeks from the weaponization threshold, according to the June IAEA reports. So the question isn't just what Graham did, it's what happens now that he's gone.
I think that's exactly the right framing, because the easy obituary line is staunch ally of Israel, and you could paste that onto a dozen senators. What made Graham different was that he didn't just vote the right way or give floor speeches. He used Senate procedure to operationalize commitments. He turned sentiment into binding defense policy that constrained future administrations. And he did it from a very specific set of institutional perches.
Walk me through those perches. Because I think most people hear a pro-Israel senator and picture someone giving a speech at AI back. Graham was clearly doing something different. I mean, think about what that actually implies operationally. An Israeli intelligence official, or a military planner, sits down with Graham and shares something they haven't yet shared with the sitting you. That's not just friendship, that's an alternative channel of communication. It's almost like having a back-channel diplomat who also happens to vote on appropriations.
Right, and it's worth pausing on how unusual that is even in the context of U-Israel relations, which are already unusually close. Plenty of senators are pro-Israel. And he used that leverage repeatedly. The 2024 supplemental is the clearest example. He locked in $3.8 billion in annual military aid to Israel, plus an additional $1.2 billion for the Iron Beam laser defense system. Iron Beam is the next generation system. It uses directed energy instead of interceptor missiles, which means the cost per shot drops from tens of thousands of dollars to basically the price of electricity. Graham didn't just fund it.
Let's trace the arc. How does someone go from being a standard-issue, hawkish Republican senator to being that guy?
Let's start with where he came from, because his origins tell us a lot about how he later pivoted. Graham was elected to the House in 1994 and the Senate in 2003. But the period that really formed him was the 2000s and 2010s, alongside John McCain and Joe Lieberman. They called themselves the Three Amigos, three senators traveling the globe together pushing hawkish interventionist foreign policy. Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya. They were for all of it. This was the neoconservative playbook, democracy promotion, military engagement, America as the world's policeman. And they didn't just vote together, they literally traveled together. They'd show up in Kabul, in Baghdad, in Tripoli, three senators walking the tarmac like a foreign policy boy band. That shared experience created a bond and a credibility that you can't get from co-sponsoring legislation.
It's hard to overstate how much that traveling mattered. When you're in a conflict zone together, you're building a shared narrative. You're hearing the same briefings, seeing the same conditions, having the same late-night conversations. That creates a kind of intellectual and personal alignment that committee hearings never will.
They're the difference between having a cost-effective defense during a crisis and not having it.
The difference between Graham and, say, Ted Cruz or Marco Rubio, who are also vocally pro-Israel, is that Graham's support came with a budget line item attached. So the question becomes, how does that guy become Trump's most trusted Senate foreign policy advisor and regular golf partner within a few years? That is not a natural evolution. That's like watching someone denounce a restaurant as a health hazard and then become its executive chef.
The easy answer is, he sold out. But I don't think that actually explains the mechanism. Plenty of people tried to get close to Trump by abandoning their priors, and it didn't work. Trump has a very sensitive radar for people who are just telling him what he wants to hear. Graham did something more specific.
He reframed rather than abandoned. Graham's core hawkishness never changed. He remained as interventionist on Iran and as committed to Israel's security as ever. What he did was recast those positions within the America First framework. He had a second institutional lever that I think is underappreciated. His role as ranking member of the Judiciary Committee's Subcommittee on Border Security. That sounds completely unrelated to Israel, but Graham used it to create a legislative coalition that shouldn't have existed. That's a very different pitch than McCain's democracy promotion universalism, and it fit Trump's worldview.
So you'd get a bill that funded Iron Dome and also funded border wall construction or increased Border Patrol staffing. The result was a coalition of pro-Israel Democrats who wanted the aid package and Border Hawk, Republicans who wanted the enforcement measures. Neither group could peel off without killing their own priority. It was procedurally brilliant. That's not selling out. That's rhetorical jujitsu.
Here's the thing about jujitsu. It only works if you understand your opponent's weight and momentum. Graham understood that Trump wasn't opposed to military strength or even military action. Trump was opposed to the nation-building part, the open-ended commitments, the democracy promotion stuff that sounded like it was designed in a think tank. So Graham just carved that part out and kept the rest.
And he backed it with concrete deliverables. Graham wasn't just making rhetorical arguments. He was chairman of the Senate Budget Committee. He sat on Judiciary, and he used those positions to embed pro-Israel policy in must-pass legislation. The 2024 supplemental that I mentioned earlier. The core of the bill was the Israel aid package, the $3.8 billion plus the Iron Beam funding. But Graham also inserted Title IV, which provided $14 billion in border security funding, including physical barrier construction in the Yuma and Tucson sectors. He wasn't just funding Israel's defense, he was making that funding durable across administrations.
That's the piece people miss when they talk about influence. It's not about having the ear of the president. It's about making your priorities structurally durable. Anyone can whisper in a president's ear. The question is whether your priorities survive that president. Graham's did, because he wrote them into law.
He had the ear of the president, too, which is the rare combination. After October 7th, Graham's rhetoric went maximalist in a way that defined the Republican consensus. He called for Israel to defeat Hamas by any and all means necessary. He urged Israel to, quote, flatten the place. In a late 2025 interview with the Times of Israel, he called Hamas religious Nazis and said, quote, I have no confidence, short of their demise, that they're ever going to do anything other than what they promised to do.
Religious Nazis is a phrase designed to foreclose any conversation about proportionality or negotiated outcomes. Once that's the frame, the only acceptable policy is total destruction of the enemy. And you can see the strategic intent behind that word choice. If they're Nazis, then anyone advocating restraint is effectively advocating appeasement. It's a rhetorical trap, and it worked. It became very difficult for any Republican to argue for a measured response without sounding like they were going soft on Nazis.
That became GOP orthodoxy. Not because Graham invented it. Plenty of people felt that way after October 7th, but because he was the one who could articulate it in terms that satisfied both the neoconservative wing that wanted moral clarity and the Trump base that wanted strength and no apologies. He bridged the two. The neocons got their moral language. The Trump base got the unapologetic force. Neither felt like they were compromising.
Let's talk about the bridge itself, because it's fragile now. Graham was uniquely positioned. He had the McCain-Lieberman credibility with the old guard. He had the Trump relationship with the new base. He had Netanyahu's personal trust, and Netanyahu doesn't trust easily. He had committee power. That's four things, and I'm not sure any other Republican senator has more than two of them. Maybe Cotton has the committee positions and the ideological alignment. Maybe Rubio has the foreign policy depth and some trust with the old guard. But all four? There's no one.
That's the succession problem. The obvious candidates are Tom Cotton and Marco Rubio. Both are strong on Israel. Both have hawkish foreign policy credentials. Cotton sits on armed services and intelligence. Rubio has been deeply involved in Iran policy. but neither of them has Graham's combination of budget committee chairmanship, which controls the purse strings, plus the personal relationship with Netanyahu, plus the golf course access to Trump. And golf course access sounds trivial, but it's not. It's unstructured time with the president in a setting where he's relaxed and receptive. You can't schedule that kind of access through official channels.
Cotton has the ideological alignment and the committee positions, but does Netanyahu call him when he wants to know what the U government isn't telling him? I doubt it. That kind of relationship isn't built through committee hearings. It's built through decades of showing up, of being reliable, of proving that you can keep a confidence.
Probably not in the same way. Graham's relationship with Netanyahu was built over decades. It wasn't just policy alignment, it was personal trust. Netanyahu's statement yesterday said, quote, "I have lost a beloved friend." That's not diplomatic boilerplate. This is a prime minister who is reportedly considering flying to South Carolina for a funeral. That's an extraordinary gesture. Heads of state don't typically fly to funerals of foreign legislators. They send delegations, they send ambassadors, they don't get on a plane themselves.
If he goes, it signals that Graham was effectively irreplaceable as a conduit between the Israeli government and the EU. You don't fly overseas for a funeral unless the person occupied a role that no one else can fill. He did it without triggering a broader war powers debate because it was buried in the NDAA, which is a 1,000-page bill that nobody reads in full except the committee staff. It's the legislative equivalent of hiding a tree in a forest.
And that's another Graham signature. He didn't grandstand. He didn't go on cable news and say, "I'm going to introduce the Graham Doctrine Bill." He just put the language in the committee print during markup. It survived the conference committee, and it became law. By the time anyone outside the defense policy world noticed, it was already on the books. Every time Graham showed up in Jerusalem, he was sending a message to Congress and to the American public. This operation has my backing, and I control the budget committee.
The Iranian reaction underscores how personally invested he was. Iranian officials and supporters celebrated his death at the funeral of slain Supreme Leader Ali Khamenei. They were holding signs condemning him. You don't get that kind of reaction unless you were seen as a genuine threat to their interests. If Graham were just another pro-Israel senator, they wouldn't have bothered. They'd have issued some generic statement and moved on. But they celebrated. That tells you they saw him as a principal architect of the policies that were hurting them.
The State Department was preparing to restrict aid to that unit, and Graham threatened to hold up State Department nominees until the review was delayed. The review got pushed back. He was a leading voice pushing Saudi-Israel normalization through the Abraham Accords, describing it as a step that could, quote, effectively end the Arab-Israeli conflict. That's the thing Iran fears most, a regional alignment that isolates them. And that's not a hypothetical. The Leahy Law Review is still pending. The State Department could move on it next month, and there's no longer a Graham-shaped obstacle in the way.
Let me push on that a little. Couldn't someone else on the Foreign Relations Committee step into that role? Senator Risch, for example. He's the ranking member. Couldn't he hold nominees?
He could, technically. Any senator can place a hold on a nominee. But Risch doesn't have the same combination of institutional credibility and demonstrated willingness to burn political capital on Israel-specific issues. A hold from Risch is a speed bump. A hold from Graham was a brick wall, because everyone knew he would actually let the government shut down rather than back off. That credibility is earned over years of actually doing it, and nobody else has earned it yet.
It's not just the formal power. It's the reputation for using it. His death removes a key voice at a moment when it may face growing scrutiny from the anti-interventionist wing of his own party, from Democrats concerned about escalation, from a public that gets war-weary. Military campaigns have political half-lives. The initial rally around the flag effect fades. Questions start getting asked. Graham was the guy who could answer those questions in a way that kept the coalition together.
The anti-interventionist wing is interesting here. Graham managed to keep them on board by framing everything through American interests and avoiding the nation-building language that the McCain era was known for. Can Cotton or Rubio do that? Cotton is more explicitly hawkish in a way that might alienate the restraint crowd. Rubio has been focused more on China. Neither has quite the same rhetorical touch. Graham could say, "We need to strike Iran," and make it sound like a hard-nosed calculation of American self-interest. Cotton says the same thing, and it sounds like he's been waiting for this moment since he was a teenager reading military history.
There's also the transparency question. Graham's office provided no details beyond brief and sudden illness. Emergency scanner audio indicated cardiac arrest. This follows Representative Tom Keene Jr.'s months-long unexplained absence for depression and Senator Mitch McConnell's recent hospitalization. Should there be more transparency around the health of senior lawmakers?
That's a legitimate governance concern. That brings us to the third effect, which I think is the most consequential long-term. The pro-Israel Republican coalition now lacks a muscle senator, someone who can credibly threaten to shut down the government over Israel funding. We saw Graham demonstrate that willingness in the 2023 government shutdown fight over the Ukraine-Israel aid separation. He was prepared to let the government close if Israel aid got stripped out or conditioned.
The public had no way to assess whether his health might affect his ability to serve. McConnell's episodes were visible on camera, freezing during press conferences, but Graham seems to have come with no public indication. Let me ask a naive question here. Why does the shutdown threat matter so much? Can't pro-Israel funding just pass through normal appropriations? They're arguably more important than CEOs. They control trillion-dollar budgets and have a role in war powers. And yet we know less about their health than we do about the CEO of a mid-cap regional bank.
The shutdown threat works because it short-circuits all of that. It says to leadership, you will keep this language clean and intact, or there is no bill. It's the difference between negotiating from a position of strength and hoping your provisions survive the gauntlet. No one wants their private medical history splashed across the news, but also, no one wants to discover that their senator has been incapacitated for months and no one told them.
It's also worth noting that Graham was in Kyiv the day before he died. His 10th visit to Ukraine, meeting with Zelensky, announcing an agreement with the Trump administration on a Russia sanctions package. The relationship becomes more dependent on executive branch continuity. If a future president, say after the 2028 election, is less committed to the current aid trajectory, there's no Senate backstop to maintain it. The whole architecture becomes vulnerable to a single election outcome.
Israel's defense establishment already sees this coming. They're recalibrating their Washington engagement strategy away from the Senate and toward the Pentagon's Defense Policy Board. They understand that the legislative route is now less reliable, so they're shifting to the executive branch channels that don't require 60 votes. You have to be there, in the room, drinking the coffee, having the side conversations that happen after the formal meeting ends.
All of this raises a practical question. For anyone watching U-Israel relations, what should we be watching for next?
It doesn't make policy, but it shapes the options that reach the secretary's desk. Israel is now investing heavily in relationships with individual board members, people like former CENTCOM commander General McKenzie, who sits on the board and has been a vocal advocate for expedited weapons transfers. The idea is to influence the Pentagon's internal recommendations before they ever reach the interagency process, let alone Congress.
I'd add a fourth. Watch the Abraham Accords expansion. Graham was pushing Saudi normalization hard, describing it as the endgame for the Arab-Israeli conflict. That effort now loses its most prominent congressional champion. The Trump administration can still pursue it, but they've lost their legislative anchor. And normalization isn't just an executive agreement. It requires congressional buy-in on things like security guarantees and arms sales. Without Graham, who carries that water?
The Saudi piece is especially interesting because Graham was uniquely positioned to sell it to both sides. To the Trump base, he could frame it as a dealmaker's legacy achievement. To the neoconservative wing, he could frame it as strategically isolating Iran. To Israel, he could frame it as security. That's three different arguments for the same policy, and he could make all of them credibly because each constituency trusted him. That's a rare skill. Most politicians have one pitch that they give to everyone. Graham had three, and he knew which one to deploy in which room.
That's the thing about bridge figures. They don't just connect groups, they translate between them. They speak multiple political languages. Graham spoke McCain, ism and Trumpism, and Netanyahu's particular idiom of security politics. Most senators speak one. And here's the thing about speaking multiple political languages. It's not just about vocabulary. It's about understanding what each audience fears and what each audience wants. Graham knew that the Trump base feared being dragged into another endless war. He knew the neocons feared American retreat. He knew Netanyahu feared a nuclear Iran. And he could address all three fears simultaneously.
The translation function is what's hardest to replace. You can find someone who holds the same policy positions. You can find someone who has Trump's ear or Netanyahu's phone number. Finding someone who has both plus committee power plus credibility with the old guard, that's a unicorn. And unicorns don't come along very often. The Senate is full of people who are good at one thing. Graham was good at four things that don't usually go together.
Let's talk about the old guard for a moment, because there's a symbolic weight to this. The three amigos are all gone now. McCain died in 2018. Lieberman died in 2024. Graham was the last one standing. That entire generation of hawkish, interventionist, bipartisan foreign policy leadership in the Senate has now passed. It's not just that three individuals died. It's that a whole approach to foreign policy has lost its standard bearers. The McCain-Lieberman-Graham model of showing up, building personal relationships, and pushing for American engagement everywhere. That model doesn't have a torchbearer anymore.
The foreign policy architecture they built remains. Military aid to Israel, opposition to Iran, the Abraham Accords framework, the post-October 7th maximalist consensus. That's their legacy, and Graham was the one who adapted it to survive the Trump realignment. The question now is whether the architecture outlasts the architects. Buildings can stand for a long time without their original builders, but eventually someone needs to do maintenance.
There's a counterargument worth considering. Maybe Graham's death doesn't create a vacuum because the consensus he built is now self-sustaining. Republican voters are pro-Israel by large margins. The party's donor class is committed. The Trump administration is actively engaged in a joint military campaign. Do you actually need one senator to hold it all together? Maybe the machinery just runs on its own now.
I think you need one senator to hold the legislative piece together. Executive actions can be reversed. Military campaigns end. What Graham did was make pro-Israel policy statutory, embedded in authorization bills, appropriations, sanctions law. That's the legacy that Herman argued about in the past, and it's what's most at risk now. Without a legislative champion, the next administration of either party has more room to shift. That's the single point of failure problem in any system. And in institutional politics, it's especially dangerous because you don't know you have a single point of failure until the failure actually happens. Graham's death is the stress test, and we're about to find out whether the system had redundancy built in.
There's a misconception I want to address here. A lot of the coverage today is going to treat Graham as just another hawkish senator who gave fiery speeches about Iran. That fundamentally misunderstands what he was doing. His power wasn't rhetorical. It was procedural and legislative. He inserted binding provisions into must-pass bills that constrain future administrations regardless of who won elections. That's the unglamorous work of legislative politics, and Graham was very good at it.
Graham's response was to embed the embassy's Jerusalem location into law through appropriations language, making it much harder for a future administration to move it back. That's the difference between a policy that lasts 4 years and one that lasts decades. They understand that personnel is policy. They understand that losing a Graham is different from losing a generic pro-Israel vote.
It's a grim metric, but it's an honest one. Your enemies tell you who mattered. If the Iranians are celebrating, it means Graham was doing something that was actually hurting them, and that's worth remembering when we talk about influence. Influence isn't about being light. It's about being effective enough that your adversaries are relieved when you're gone.
Let's wrap up with one open question that will tell us a lot about where things go from here. Will Netanyahu attend the funeral? And if he does, what signal does it send about the state of U-Israel relations at this moment?
If he goes, it says the relationship has lost something structural. Not just a friendly voice, but a load-bearing element of the architecture. You don't make that trip for a symbolic gesture. Let's talk about what listeners should actually watch for in the coming months. Because I think there are specific, measurable indicators of whether Graham's legacy holds or collapses. He flies to South Carolina to send a message to Washington that there's a vacancy that needs filling.
When the fiscal year 2027 bill comes out, compare the Israel-specific language to the fiscal year 2026 version. Are the Graham provisions on Iranian naval harassment reporting still in there? is the Iron Beam funding line maintained at the $1.2 billion level? If those provisions drop out or get watered down, the institutional shift is real and it's happening fast. The question is, who maintains it, and whether anyone can maintain it the way Graham did, by being useful to everyone simultaneously.
If the new senator ends up on agriculture and commerce, that tells you the Republican conference didn't prioritize maintaining South Carolina's Israel security infrastructure. Graham was genuinely useful across factions, and that's what made him dangerous to Iran and indispensable to Israel. Being useful to everyone means you have leverage with everyone. And leverage is what turns policy preferences into actual outcomes.
If the next NDAA doesn't include the Graham provisions on Iran and Iron Beam, that's empirical evidence that the institutional muscle has atrophied. Right now, the joint campaign against Iran is ongoing. The Abraham Accords expansion is in progress. The aid packages are funded. Everything looks fine. The question is, what happens the next time there's a stress? A funding fight, an escalation debate, a diplomatic crisis? That's when you find out whether the architecture holds without the architect.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
The Turkish oil wrestling festival known as Kirkpınar traces its name to the phrase 40 springs, a reference to a legend in which 40 Ottoman soldiers wrestled to the death after a military campaign, and the two finalists were found dead, locked in combat, with the spring bubbling beneath each of their bodies. The word yaklo means oiled, and competitors still coat themselves in olive oil before matches, a tradition dating back more than 600 years.
Let me underscore what weeks from weaponization threshold actually means in operational terms. It doesn't mean Iran has a nuclear weapon.
I feel like there's a metaphor in there somewhere about Graham and the Senate, but I'm not going to be the one to find it.
And once they cross that threshold, the window for a military response closes dramatically, because you're no longer striking a program, you're striking a nuclear-armed state.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, my weird prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.